All right. So I'm not exactly sure how it works out this way, but 1 week, the schedule kind of worked out for Ezra and Nehemiah, Esther all being crammed in and a 10,000-foot flyover. And today, the only thing we're doing is Haggai. So if you've ever wondered how to pronounce Haggai, that's the English way, and the Brits say it somehow different that I usually can't remember and understand. So two G's is never quite the easiest way, or to go from Hebrew to English is never the easiest way to remember how to pronounce. So what we're actually going to do today is, for the most part, read through and just kind of pull out Haggai. So if you haven't read Haggai in the last year, this is going to be a great morning for you. First, let's just try and kind of remember what's going on in the whole context around Haggai, right? So as far as the flow of redemptive history, all right, so when we look at the plan of God, what I know every single one of us to be able to do is, wherever you get dropped in the storyline of the Bible, whatever book you get dropped into, we don't want just Christians that can simply recount a famous verse from that section. We want you to be comfortable to get dropped in any portion of the Bible and to know where you're at in the unfolding plan of God. So if you get dropped in Haggai, you get dropped in 2 Chronicles, you get dropped in Deuteronomy, you kind of see what's going on. The most normal way is to watch the flow of the Bible through the covenants, all right? So you have God making the world, and he makes some kind of agreement there. It looks very similar to a covenant, where he's making an agreement with Adam, but it's the foundation for everything else that comes. Everyone's going to be referring back to what God did in creation. That means God owns things. He establishes things. And then the storyline moved to Noah, right? As sin entered the world through Adam, then God makes a covenant with Noah where he promises to preserve the world from the flood again. He promises to preserve and care for the creation. That it's almost as if that covenant allows for everything else to be built upon it. So it establishes that God will, until the end of time, care for his world. He is not going to, at one point, because it gets so bad, just dump it again. He's got a plan that's going to unfold, which moves us to Abraham, where God specifically chooses some star worshiper out of Babylon, pulls him and draws him to himself, and promises him a people and a land, right? And that's going to set the trajectory then for the rest of what's going to come. That's going to give us the establishment of the Israelite nation. Then God saves the people out of Egypt, he brings them to Sinai, and he makes the covenant with the people of Israel there, right? That establishes them both as a nation. It makes them as if a wife to Yahweh himself. It binds them, and it gives kind of the structure of how all of the rest of the prophets are going to be thinking, because as has been mentioned several times, the prophets are not just coming up, this is what God wants. They're taking all of the laws, the statutes, the rules that were given to Moses, and they're applying them. We'll see in Haggai, especially when Moses gets to Deuteronomy 28, he sets half the tribes on one hill over here, half on this hill over here, and they recount the blessings and curses to each other. That there's blessings for walking in obedience to Yahweh, and there's curses for the disobedience. And those are very, very tangible blessings and curses. You'll be in the land. You'll be out of the land. Your animals will, you know, be successful. They won't have miscarriages, all of those kinds of things, versus your animals, the crops, everything will fail. So they're very tangible curses and blessings, but they're, of course, they're very well pointing toward you need new hearts. You want blessings that are even far bigger than this. The biggest blessings are, I will be with you, which Haggai is going to bring up again. You will be my people. I will be your God. So those kind, whenever you see that, whenever you read that in the Old Testament, you will be my people. I will be your God. That's covenant language. Okay? So that's going to drive a whole bunch. But even then, what's unfolding is then David is going to be given covenant blessings within that. There will always be a son to reign forever. And so your eyes, as you're watching through the Mosaic covenant, you're still looking for all of these Abrahamic blessings that are going to spread to the whole world, but then you start looking for even more specifics of, okay, this promise is going to be to someone in David's line. Either the king's going to be coming back because we're in exile now, or There's got to be something that unfolds. There's got to be some sort of king who can keep all of these promises. He will be this faithful son, and through him, a kingdom's going to be established forever. All right, and then, of course, that drives us into the New Testament and all of the blessings that come with our new covenant. Isaiah calls it the everlasting covenant. All right, so that's we keep that in mind because that's our ever-flowing kind of redemptive history. Now, specifically in Haggai, all right, so you have in 586, Judah's wiped off the map. They go to Babylon. They've got their exile. 539, Cyrus finally defeats the Persian Empire as established. The next year in 538, he is making this proclamation. He is sending whoever wants to go back from the Jews back to their homeland. So they can travel, they can go back, and they even have the blessing of the Persian treasury to help them rebuild this temple. Cyrus wants prayers to be made from that temple for him and for his children. So there's a promise, or there's an establishment here that this is where the temple should be built. The Jews wanted that, and now they're being sent off in 539, 538. About 50,000 Jews are now headed back the 900 miles back to the promised land. With them are, you know, I assume Haggai, Zechariah, Zerubbabel, the governor, he's going with them. So all of this is happening, and you can read about all of that in kind of the first six chapters of Ezra, okay? So that's what's being described in the early parts of Ezra. 536, you can read in the Ezra 4 and 5, 536, the foundations of the temple are already built. So if the proclamation is made in 538, 2 years later, the foundations are actually built. And there's that story in Ezra about the old men kind of have this memory about what the glorious temple was. And so they're weeping while they're rejoicing. It's kind of this back and forth of this temple with what the resources we've got is going to pale in comparison. But we're started. All right? Right shortly after that, there's kind of this conflict from the Samaritans in the northern region. They're coming in. They're watching. They're watching as the foundations being built, and they start to put pressure on the community of the Israelites that are there working. They send off, they have things canceled for a time. The Jews get a letter of reinstatement, but something happens, whether it's with the zeal and the energy to get it done, whether it happens because there's confusion about what needs to be done, but there is a gap of 16 years here where almost nothing is done on the foundations of the temple. So there's 16 years where they know what they're supposed to do, and nothing is done. And this is the situation that Haggai is preaching to in 520 BC. And it's not only just, we generally know 520 BC, we know the dates of all four sermons that Haggai preaches to the people. I mean, it is down to the specifics. And so we don't know anything about where Haggai is born. We don't know about anything about his death. What we know about this man comes in four sermons he preached in one fall in 520 BC. And it's this word that is still with us today and is pointing forward to all sorts of other things. So this is where we are. And coming out of these four sermons is a motivation, a renewal of the people to finish the temple, which is done 516, 515 BC, kind of depending on what, you know, let's say 516, they get most of the temple done, and 515, the trim is finally put on the inside. All right? It's that kind of project. So Haggai is what God uses. His word here stirs the people to finish what they're supposed to do. All right? So we're gonna start by just reading chapter 1, and you're gonna see this gap right here is what Haggai is gonna target in the people. So Haggai chapter 1, in the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, on the first day of the month, the word of the Lord came by the hand of Haggai the prophet to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest. And this is what it says. Thus says Yahweh of hosts, these people say the time has not yet come to rebuild the house of Yahweh. Then the word of Yahweh came by the hand of Haggai the prophet. Is it a time for you yourselves to dwell in your paneled houses while this house lies in ruins? Now, therefore, thus says Yahweh of hosts, consider your ways. You have sown much and harvested little. You eat, but you never have enough. You drink, but you never have your fill. You clothe yourselves, but no one is warm. And he who earns wages does so to put them into a bag with holes. All right, so you can see there in verses 2, there's something that the people are saying that is keeping them from finishing the task that they're supposed to do. He's talking about this temple, right? They delayed it. They've become apathetic to finishing the project, finishing what they're supposed to do. It's something about these people that they're not actually interpreting reality right around them. And that's what comes out here in verse 6. He's pointing and he's helping them look up. Look and see the devastated economy that's all around you. You're sowing, but your crops aren't coming in mass amounts. You're not everything you drink, but you never have a fill. It's minor cups. Inflation is so much that no matter how much you spend, it feels like, you carry your money around in a purse, it feels like there's a hole in it. It goes through. It doesn't matter how much you have to actually spend. He's telling them, look around. You remember the covenant blessings that Moses promised to his people. When you are acting and living in covenant faithfulness, you know the blessings that pour out. And yet here you are, being apathetic toward the temple, building your own rich houses off to the side, and assuming that you're going to get some kind of blessing from it. If they looked around, if they had spiritual eyes to see, they would see that all of the things that are happening to them, even in their regular, just regular living life, in accordance with the Mosaic covenant, are showing them that they need to turn their eyes back towards the presence of God, back toward finishing what's been commanded. All right, we're going to see this in Haggai 2, but it's not because God just cares about having a building, but it's because the actual priorities of the people have just been completely become twisted. They're lost. So keep reading this. This will get spelled out more in the rest of this this prophecy. So thus says Yahweh of hosts. So Haggai is continuing here. Consider your ways. Go up to the hills and bring wood and build the house, that I may take pleasure in it and that I may be glorified, says Yahweh. You looked for much, and behold, it came to little. And when you brought it home, I blew it away. Why? Okay, so why is there economic collapse when these things are happening? Why, declares the Lord of hosts, because of my house that lies in ruin, while each of you busies himself with his own house. Okay, so there's the condemnation that Haggai is bringing to the people. Look around you, see it. What is going on in your hearts? And Haggai just tells them what they're thinking. Your minds are obsessed and consumed with your own little house, and you're neglecting some sort of like a bigger vision that this is God's people, this is God's place. If you don't have a central place where my spirit dwells, what on earth do you think? What do you think you're going to be without the Lord? What are you going to be? I mean, this is the same kind of idea that Moses worked so hard to remove from the people back in Exodus and Deuteronomy. Do you think you were mighty? I mean, do you think you saved yourself from Egypt? Do you think you had resources within yourself to do what happened to you? They should be looking back on the exile now, thinking in the same kinds of terms. Why is it you're here? How did you get to this point? A simple reflection on that and says, well, we were pretty good as far as negotiating with Cyrus, and then we convinced Cyrus that, hey, he should send us back and open the treasury, bring us back. No, a simple reading of almost any of the prophets would have said, God made a declaration that after 70 years, we would be here. That's why we're here, and that's why we should be building the temple. So that's Haggai is looking into their hearts, and he's exposing that they have kind of a self-preoccupation with their own house at this point. So here's the therefore, verse 10. Therefore, the heavens above you have withheld the dew, and the earth has withheld its produce. And I have called for a drought on the land and the hills, on the grain, the new wine, the oil, and what the ground brings forth, on man and beast, and on all their labors. So Haggai is bringing to bear those covenant curses that Moses had promised in Deuteronomy. He's reiterating them again. You're looking around. Of course the heavens are stopped up. Look at how you're living in relation to Yahweh at this point. Look how you're thinking about the temple. Okay, so you can see how Haggai, he's prosecuting using what Moses gave him. All right. Let's see how they respond then. Verse 12. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of Yahweh their God and the words of Haggai the prophet. As the Lord their God had sent, as the Lord their God had sent him, and the people feared Yahweh, and then spoke to the people with Yahweh's message, I am with you, declares the Lord. And Yahweh stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people, and they came and worked on the house of Yahweh of hosts, their God, on the 24th day of the month, the sixth month, in the second year of Darius the king. So that date at the end there is approximately September 21st. So if Haggai starts preaching on the 29th and starts giving this message out to the people, something dramatic has happened in the next 30 days. Something is working. Every time Zerubbabel, every time Joshua hears this message, it's stirring something in the pit of their stomach, like, I've been here and I haven't been leading the people. I haven't been pushing them toward this. I haven't been seeing it correctly. And then there's something that happens as far as the fear of the Lord dropping on Israel. And we see this at times. I remember one pastor telling me he felt like their church had been in cruise control for a long time. And then it finally came. They had been neglecting doing any sort of like discipline. They had several people. There was conflict in the church. They had for a long time not done any sort of discipline as far as saying, by the evidence of your life, the congregation does not believe your confession is a true confession, and we are putting you out of the church. And they did that to a few of the people that were in the church and were not repenting and pursued certain sins or whatever. And he said he can remember walking away from that meeting, and it was his description, the fear of the Lord had dropped right on that church. People had realized the Lord was very, very serious about the way he describes his church, what he wants from his church, how he thinks about his church, what he's doing in designing his church. So there's a sense in which people become Christians, or can be sleepy Christians, and as the word is preached, as obedience happens, people are awakened to those truths and they become actual realities that people begin to actually put into practice. That's what's happening in this first sermon that Haggai is working on. And it's all about this neglect of the temple. Okay? So that's Haggai 1. Haggai 2 is three more sermons. October 17th, and then two on December 18th. And in them, these are all going to be motivations for the people to continue working on the temple. Okay? The first one has to do with glory. The second one has to do with holiness. And the third one has to do to getting a vision about what God's going to do through David again. Because there's no one on the throne at this point. There's no sign that, I mean, there's probably hope that Zerubbabel is going to become king, but there's no one actually on the throne at this point. So let's start looking at Haggai 2. All right, so in the seventh month, on the 21st day of the month, the word of Yahweh came by the hand of Haggai the prophet. Speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and to all the remnant of the people, and say, "Who is left among you who saw this house in its former glory?" All right, so there's the question that should remind you about what happened in Ezra. As the foundations were finished, how did people view it in comparison to the glory of Solomon's temple? Right? It's kind of disheartening if you came from the, you know, you came from a building that had spires and beautiful brickwork and stained glass windows, and now you're looking at, you know, working out of somebody's garage. Right? It's that kind of transition from glory to now they're looking at what they're doing and saying, what's the point? Okay? So if you start comparing glory versus what they're doing now, it can be disheartening for the people. So here's Haggai's motivation for them. "How do you see it now? Is it not as nothing in your eyes? Yet now be strong. O Zerubbabel, declares Yahweh, be strong, O Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Be strong, all you people of the land, declares the Lord. Work, for I am with you, declares Yahweh of hosts, according to the covenant that I made with you when you came out of Egypt. My spirit remains in your midst. Fear not." All right, so the first bit of motivation that he's aiming for is to remind them, I'm in your midst. Okay, so if we move to the New Testament now, right, we're not trying to rebuild any sort of physical temple. Right? There's plenty of sermons. You can go find them all over on YouTube that go to Haggai chapter 1, go to his sermon and say, okay, let's consider our building, this place where God is, and they use it as motivation to let's take care of the place we're at, or let's restore the place where we're at. I mean, it's been used 1,000 times over for building projects, right? But if you're reading through and you're reading your Bible, you know that this temple is done as soon as you read the words of, as soon as you read Jesus stick three fingers up in the air and him saying, destroy this temple in 3 days and I will raise it up. All right, so we're moving from this and no longer having our sacrifice or our glory there to our glory being found in Christ. And then, of course, from that, Ephesians 2, we're looking at, outside of that, we all become that temple, right? So there is a certain bit of, you know, kind of just same language that comes across in the New Testament that says, consider the house that needs to be built, consider the temple where the people of God are, who the people of God are, and now, like in Haggai 2, he talks about his spirit being there. The Spirit came down on the tabernacle. The Spirit came down on the temple. And what happens when God talks about the people of God? What is dwelling in them? The Spirit. The Spirit in Ephesians 2 becomes the place. I mean, the people become the place where the Spirit of God is now dwelling. Right? And you think at the end of Matthew, where Jesus is commissioning all of his people to go preach, baptize, what's his comfort to them? I'm with you always. Right? What's his comfort to them at the end of the whole book of Revelation? I am coming soon. But he reminds them in the whole beginning of Revelation, he's walking amongst them. So in Haggai's terms, he's thinking of how desperate it is that the presence of God be at the center of his people. Okay, we're moving across the ages to seeing everything in clear light, seeing things in fulfillment, but we're talking in the same kind of language. We're using the same kinds of Old Testament word pictures, shadows, and talking about the fullness of them. That's why we see things in much clearer light. All right, so let's continue with this sermon here that he's talking about in Haggai 2. All right, so verse 6. So he's just told them, you know, my spirit will be with you. Don't fear. Verse 6, for thus says Yahweh of hosts, yet once more in a little while I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all nations so that the treasures of all the nations shall come in, and I will fill this house with glory, says Yahweh of hosts. The silver is mine, the gold is mine, declares Yahweh of hosts. The latter glory of this house shall be greater than the former, says Yahweh of hosts. And in this place I will give peace. All right, so if you're one of the wall workers on October 17th listening to this message, you've got to come to some kind of category of thinking, okay, Haggai is over here talking to us. I'm pasting this cheap whatever stone. You know, we're getting wood that's now up. This temple might be even somewhat of the same size, but it's got none of the splendor of the previous. Where is it ever going to actually reach that kind of pinnacle? Right? That's the concern and the desperation the workers are feeling. And Haggai is speaking to it saying, don't worry. God owns the treasures of heaven, and he will distribute them freely. If you unite yourself, if you live in this presence of the Spirit that he's saying, if you work, if you should take hope that the glories will be even greater. In their generation, this is just the way the Old Testament prophecy works so much. In their generation, they don't see it. Some of them obviously live the next 5-6 years. They see the temple finished. There's rejoicing in that. Some of their great-great-grandchildren might see Herod take that temple and expand it and make it quite a spectacle, right? But ultimately, it's pointing you to try to think, when is real glory going to be restored to this kind of place? When is glory that's talked about that's even blowing away what Solomon done going to come to this place? Right? Again, it makes the heart kind of anticipate, when is the Lord himself going to show up and turn this place into a temple that draws in all the nations? They can pull riches and gold from everywhere. Well, obviously, I mean, you hear Jesus Christ as he walks through people, he comes up to a rich man, right? And he says, hey, you're trying to keep the law, that's great, but if you want to follow me, sell all you have, and you will have riches in heaven. And all of a sudden, that idea, that rich man who comes to him, Jesus is promising him all the more riches and all the more treasure, and yet he walks away sad because he can only see it in terms of what's right there in his current bank account or his current investments. He can't see that as soon as he lets that go, the treasures are just going to abound far more than he ever anticipated. Right? These kind of verses that Haggai is talking about, he's picking up themes of whatever it is, what kind of glimpse he sees of Yahweh's presence coming. Whenever Yahweh's presence comes, it's going to bring enormous blessings and flow out from there. That's, of course, going to be epitomized in the Lord Jesus Christ. All right, so that's what's happening. This is a motivational speech, a kind of, your faith has to have enough vision to capture the sorts of things that are going to come. Your faith has to have big enough categories to see that the Lord is going to completely reverse everything that's happening. His Spirit's going to be there, and what you see now as small, paltry, tiny is going to be flooded with glory and weightiness and riches. Okay? It's the same kind of dynamic we look at in all sorts of New Testament verses that promise, okay, people of God, lift your eyes up, remember what's coming. Remember what will be ours. Remember the kind of positions that are going to be established for you. Same kind of lift your eyes up to the vision. But that's the same way that Haggai is preaching to this people. So, out of those first two, is there any questions on that? All right, let's jump into sermon 3. So a couple more months pass by now. And so we're in December now. We're past the harvest. Everything should have been brought in. But of course, as we read in chapter 1, it's been a poor year as far as harvest, as far as availability, as far as a great amount of anything compared to what they've sown. So they're past that. On the 24th day of the ninth month, this is verse 10 of chapter 2, in the second year of Darius, the word of Yahweh came by Haggai the prophet. Thus says Yahweh of hosts, ask the priests about the law. Because if anybody knows about the law, it's the priest, right? If someone carries holy meat in the fold of his garment and touches with his fold bread or stew or wine or oil or any kind of food, does it become holy? Okay, so the question that he's just putting to him there is, if I'm carrying something and it's supposed to be holy and it just bumps up against other things, does it make the other things holy? Is there a passing of that holiness to anything else? And of course, right, the priest answered no. But then Haggai said, if someone who is unclean by the contact with a dead body touches any of these, does it become unclean? And the priest answered and said, it does become unclean. Right? So the Levitical law then would put out on the counter side, if you've been unclean, not consecrated, not devoted as holy, before you come to the temple, one of those being touching a dead body, how does that affect the other things that you come in? Well, it affects it greatly. It makes that item unclean. So as far as passing uncleanness, the transference there absolutely happens. All right? Now he's going to use these two principles, these two laws from the Old Testament, to make a point to the people. Verse 14, then Haggai answered and said, So is it with this people and with this nation before me, declares Yahweh, and so with every work of their hands, and what they offer there is unclean. Now then, consider from this day onward, before stone was placed upon stone in the temple of Yahweh, how did you fare? When one came to a heap of 20 measures, and there were but 10. When one came to the wine vat to draw 50 measures, and there were but 20. I struck you and all the products of your toil with blight and with mildew and with hail, yet you did not turn to me, declares Yahweh. Consider from this day onward, from the 24th day of the ninth month, since the day that the foundation of Yahweh's temple was laid, consider, is the seed yet in the barn? Indeed, the vine, the fig tree, the pomegranate, the olive tree have yielded nothing, but from this day on, I will bless you. All right? So what Haggai is doing in this sermon is he's trying to give the people, he's using that those two principles from the Levitical law to tell the people, okay, now you might be working in the temple, but don't get it into your mind that simply because you're laying stone upon stone, wood piece upon wood piece, that somehow that's going to just make you holy. As if working on the temple is suddenly going to transfer holiness to you. And remember again, get the spiritual eyes to look around you. What happened when you brought in the wheat, right? You sowed enough to get 20. You got 10. You sowed enough to get 10 gallons. You got 5. Right? Look at your olive trees. Look at the orchards. When you're pulling from those, what were you expecting based on what you put in? If you're treating this building of the temple this way, you're going to be sorely mistaken. Right? But his promise is, instead of thinking about the temple as some sort of talisman that's going to get you holiness, going to get you the blessing of God, reverse your thinking and start thinking about, okay, if I'm obeying God and doing it in the way that he has asked us to, then all of a sudden I should expect the blessings to flow. And that's how he's finishing his second sermon. The mindset you have isn't going to get you blessings. I will count blessings to you if instead you reverse your thinking. If you think about holiness as actually obeying and striving to do the things that please God. Speaking of Keller, I remember Tim Keller actually saying once, An easy way to think about our sanctification is we are striving to become holy to please God, not to appease God. Right? So that it helps make that distinction of if you're seeking to try to do these things to get the blessing, it all falls to pieces. If you know that the blessings come because you walk with the Lord, then they flow and you can see them in infinite measure all over the place. And so Haggai is trying to help the people see, and using the law as kind of this parable, helping them see the reality around them. All right? So there's the third sermon on holiness. Now, this is not a plug for Sunday evening services, but the same day, later that day, Haggai comes and he preaches another sermon. We are going to have a fifth Sunday sermon in November, though, so we would love to have you here to hear some testimonies and other things. I'm just plugging that now. But here's Haggai coming later on December 18th, and he says in verse 20, "The word of the Lord came a second time to Haggai on the 24th day of the month. Speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I'm about to shake the heavens and the earth, and to overthrow the kingdoms. I'm about to destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the nations, and overthrow the chariots and their riders, and the horses and their riders shall go down, every one by the sword of his brother. On that day, declares Yahweh of hosts, I will take you, O Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, declares Yahweh, and I will make you like a signet ring, for I have chosen you, declares Yahweh of hosts." Right? So here he is, as he's talked to them about the reversal, now he comes again with an extreme sermon of hope. He will use Zerubbabel to establish his everlasting kingdom. All right? So just flip a few pages over to Matthew 1. So this is both true in both Matthew's gospel and Luke's gospel. But look at chapter 1, verse 12. "And after the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel. Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel, the father of Abiud. Abiud, the father of Eliakim. Eliakim, the father of Azor. Azor, the father of Zadok. Zadok, the father of Akim. Akim, the father of Eliud. Eliud, the father of Eleazar. Eleazar, the father of Mathan. Mathan, the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called what? The Christ. Who is called the Messiah. Matthew's spelling this out, helping you tie it together to see who's actually coming to be king. Who is the Christ, the King, the Messiah. Okay? Look at the promise again. Go back to Haggai 2. Nations are going to get tossed around in order for God to bring this promise about. And he finishes the book again. Verse 23. "On that day, declares Yahweh of hosts," or Yahweh of armies, "I will take you, O Zerubbabel, my servant." Okay? When you hear "my servant," you should think of some in terms of what's happened at the end of Isaiah. This servant figure who is doing the work of Yahweh, who is bringing this kingdom, who is establishing things that are going to last forever. So now Zerubbabel is not just, future king, but he's the servant of Yahweh. "The son of Shealtiel, declares Yahweh, I will make you like a signet ring, for I have chosen you, declares the Lord." So, just like a king's seal, he is going to bring about whatever Yahweh is to pass. Now, at this point, again, Haggai, unless he's also reading Daniel, it's not clear in a lot of places that there's going to be this kind of huge gap now, this 70th week that's happening between what God is accomplishing in the return and the coming of this final kingdom that rolls in and is going to take over, become a mountain that takes over the whole world, as Daniel 2 talks about. But you see a little picture of it there in Daniel. But then, when we come to the pages of the New Testament, it's just all over the place. Romans begins with this, because of the resurrection from the dead, he has been appointed the Son of David, the Son of God. Right? So these are the promises that now we're reaping, having seen clearly. Haggai has at least, all three of his motivational sermons are the exact same way that we try to motivate one another. What work needs to be done in our midst? What are the commands that Christ has given us? But it's not just simple kind of, okay, do them, and then suddenly you're going to get all of God's blessings. We point toward, future visions of glory, what are going to be ours. We remind people that holiness comes through being connected to God. We try to remind one another all the time that everything has been fulfilled in Christ. Are you wrestling with who Christ is and what he's done more and more and more? Like, the motivations, the way that Haggai preaches, is the same way that the New Testament authors try to stir up the people of God for unity, for peace, for blessing, for evangelism, and everything else that comes out of it. So, are there any questions on Haggai from what you read? Oh, yeah, Dave. Right. Right. So, I mean, Dave's just making the point. The Jews have to transition from physical to, you will now worship me in spirit and truth. John 4, kind of, as the Samaritan woman at the well. There's a huge shift there. But you see it, right, even in the paralytic. When they drop in Mark 2, where they drop the paralytic through, why are the Pharisees so upset that Jesus looks at them and says, your sins are forgiven? Well, yes, because Jesus is saying your sins are forgiven, able to claim that. But part of the reason is also that he's doing it completely outside the temple. The temple is where you go to get forgiveness of sins. And Jesus is going in someone's house. He's making this declaration as well. So there's this kind of, no, those things can't even happen outside of this logistical place. And so, for years, all the promises, unless you're looking with eyes of faith to see that a temple, and I guess Hebrews is probably just the best overall illustration. You're having yearly sorts of things. You're looking at things, and you can't see the heavenly temple that this is just a picture of. I mean, that's the biggest issue, is that, right, it's earthly temple that can't encapsulate all that God is. It's the hot spot of God's presence, but it's not all of God's presence. Isaiah 66, 2, saying, sitting in the heavens, my feet are footstools on the earth, is already building that kind of disconnect that I think Israel should have been reading and saying, we need to be looking for a temple that is cosmic and global in scale. Where would that be found? Well, it's found in the person of Jesus Christ. So the hints are there, but it's easy for us to say, why didn't you see those hints and clamp onto them? And this feels so much more secure. Get the temple built, get the blessings. So, all right, well, let's get ready for worship.